Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on the companies we mention. Please do your own research.
And it's a very warm welcome to Monday Upbeat Markets with me, Graham Dixon.
Me, Kevin Hornsby.
Me, Charles Archer.
So where do we start? What's been happening this weekend for you guys?
Well, I've been playing golf, looking at the Pacific Ocean in the middle of Hawaii. It was very nice. My golf was not very nice, but the whole situation was very nice. Yeah, that's about all I've been doing, really.
Yeah, and I've been looking at the SpaceX IPO and wondering, can the cult of Elon Musk's personality send it above $2 trillion on day one? Or are we going to see a massive liquidity wipeout within the first couple of weeks, or possibly both? It's quite hard to know. What have you been up to, Graham?
Swimming, eating, driving. Nothing remarkable.
You guys don't do any work, do you, actually? Kevin just sits on the beach and Graham comes out by the pool.
Okay, so now we're going to introduce our first guest. Our first guest is David, the CEO of Acuity Risk Management.
Hello, David from Acuity Risk Management. How are you today, sir?
Doing wonderful. How are you, Charles?
I am enjoying a lot of very heavy rain in Devon at the moment because I made the mistake of complaining about the beautiful sunshine that was scorching us. Now the temperature's come right back down and the garden is flooded. So, you know, could we just have a nice warm weather with a few clouds and a bit of wind? But apparently not. How are you, sir?
Yep, doing great. Yeah, it's definitely either chilly or it will be scorching hot apparently again at the end of next week. So.
Yeah,
but I'm actually looking forward to that.
Well, I think do you know what I quite like is I quite like the seasons behaving. You know, I quite like winter being cold and rainy, which it was, and summer being sunny. But ultimately, you know, we the children and I we're all booked in on a go to Disneyland Paris at the start of August because we kind of wife actually made the comment probably shouldn't have that it'll definitely be sunny in that week. So obviously it'll be pouring down with rain, but we will see. On the Acuity front, how goes Acuity? Full steam ahead. You look a little bit tired, which is, might sound bad, but it's a compliment from me. It means you're working hard.
Oh, we're definitely working hard. We are, there's a lot of fronts that we're opening and really pushing on the sales and marketing front to start to grow the top line after we've done a cost reset and have now got the business on a sustainable path. And we're just looking to start growing the top line now.
Mm. Well, we had an RNS out today. One of your awards has seen a new 3-year contract, one of your customers, value in excess of £100,000. And that comprises a professional services component covering the migration and TPRM deployment and a recurring subscription component, which is exactly what you want to see. In a company of this size and of this type, recurring revenue. But also, it's funny because the market tends to react more to new customers, but actually, a former customer liking what they see and increasing what they're spending is possibly more valuable.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. This we always like to see these expansions, and we do tend to get these expansion opportunities with our current base because they are. Once they've invested in making Stream Classic a success, then they generally tend to stick and even expand. And this particular contract even unlocks potential further expansion because we can do things like integrations with IT ticketing systems, with finance systems, and offer even a greater range of services within our platform.
Well, it's interesting. I was speaking to a private client of mine who are just not ready to list for another few months at least. And I was saying actually that this was something that they lacked, which is that they had quite an expensive option to onboard their software and their technology. But for a lot of clients, when you're trying to make the sales pitch, they want it's almost like try before you buy. As in, they want something that's kind of entry level, check the tech works. And then more importantly, often check that the user experience is easy and simple and intuitive. And then they'll spend more. And this is what we've had here. And I think maybe, you know, for people who maybe don't know the story particularly well, just summarize almost how that funnel works.
Yeah, sure. I mean, one new element in our arsenal is Stream Cloud, which we've only recently launched. And that gives exactly what you were talking about, is an easy entry point where people see value quickly. They don't need a great deal of resources to be onboarded, either from the client side or from our side. And as they become a more mature in terms of their GRC readiness or risk, cyber risk management readiness, then they can upgrade to more advanced modeling, having automated workflows and other added features that then become part of how they do governance, risk, and compliance.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think it's for me, I think it's the fact that, you know, the investor base here are now seeing the company turn a corner almost in terms of the revenue is increasing. There's a very clear sort of project pathway. The revenue as it laid out is the way it should be. But more importantly, I suppose, obviously you're going after governments, you're going after enterprise, but you have the ability to match an offering to multiple different, you know, types of customer, but also multiple different sizes of customer in a way that most people can't do. And then the other thing is just in terms of, you know, the risk mate, is that, you know, the problem you're trying to solve, which is, you know, in many ways is external risk. You know, it's not internal to a company. There's very few solutions for that. They just don't exist. So your scaling, your ability to scale, it's in almost any other software business, you're up against really fierce competition. There is competition in the space, but it's not incredibly high. And why is that, I guess, is the question.
In the on-prem space, I think we've managed to secure a wedge into the UK public sector, and those that haven't find it very difficult to break in there. So they're often dissuaded from even investing in the first place. So that's one element. One is we've proven ourselves in the most sensitive parts of government and the ones that need to be the most secure. And therefore, there's a trust factor that we have that other companies don't have. Mm-hmm. So that provides us somewhat of a moat, especially in the UK public sector and defense industry. So yeah, this particular organization they work closely with the public sector, and they're almost a quasi public sector organization because of that.
Yeah, I mean, often what the difference between public sector and completely funded by the government but not public sector? There's no real difference at all. Often, it's particularly where in organizations like this, all of the personnel are former civil servants or former public sector workers. Yeah. And the government just wants to have it like slightly at arm's length for whatever reason. And often that's where, you know, that's where small startups can actually find it easier because they have more autonomy in terms of the clients that they pick and who they want to work for. But the other thing I think, which is kind of like really helps with the investment case is the board level cyber GRC, right? So I, for example, I probably know more about computing than most, and I am not a computer expert on any level. So when you talk cybersecurity, I know that it's something that I need, but it's not something that I want to spend ages and ages on. Yep. You stream translates what is, you know, very complex, highly technical cybersecurity IT data into straightforward visual risk reports that are actionable in a way that like a non-specialist can deal with. And I think actually, that's probably one of the most important parts of the investment case, because I've seen it with kind of very large companies where like a cybersecurity risk report will come back and it'll go to a higher level. And the people higher up literally don't understand why it's important or what needs to get done. Whereas almost like a traffic light, this is big red light, sort it out. It's just easier to action, isn't it? It just is. And then having the solution for it as well, just great.
Yeah, absolutely. We can do all the advanced modeling and complex guided workflows, but what we ultimately provide is actionable intelligence that say, here are your top priorities and here are the things that you need to focus on in order to make yourself more secure from a cybersecurity perspective. That is the case with Stream, and that's our guiding mission, if you will. It will also be the case when we build our next product, the AI native Risk OS product. We'll make it even more clear in boardrooms from a business impact perspective, the impact that making certain investments will have or not making those investments.
Well,
that is really the goal, is to make the boardroom understand things and not report on technical vulnerabilities and such, but really translate that into business terms.
Yeah, I think the funny thing is with cybersecurity is that companies just don't want to spend any money on it because, and one of the key problems of it, you know, from the cybersecurity people that I know, all of them probably a lot cleverer than I am, is the complaint almost is that if there's nothing going wrong at the company, then they're not doing anything. But management don't realize that actually the reason nothing's going wrong is because that person is there to put out fires before they become a fire, right? And you only need to, you know, walk into the co-op a few months ago and there weren't any sandwiches because there was a hack, you know, or various other. And there's like real front-facing risk that I think more companies are now starting to realize that actually the cost of what is effectively insurance is worth the money. You know, and you were saying, you know, in terms of potential of government contracts and public sector contracts, the other thing that you have, which a lot of your, you know, potential competitors don't have, I mean, you are cloud accessible, but Stream natively supports private cloud on-premise deployments. So, you know, defense sector, government, heavy utilities, they get to retain control over their sensitive infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And that's the other, you know, and that, I think that kind of broadens out the package deal that you have. So it's almost when you're creating a sales funnel, you can say, well, you can retain control of your data. We have security first architecture. It's really easy and straightforward. And also you can start on a level, you know, an entry level package. So you can test it out. And it's really nice to see that you're having multiple contracts now, multiple customers coming back and saying, we really like it. Well, yeah, upgrade our package. We want to spend more money. And the funnel grows, the revenue grows, and away you go.
Absolutely. Yeah, we definitely have some exciting plans. I think it is down to, in large part, due to the quality of our consulting team. So we've got Richard Mayo is a world-class cyber risk expert. And so part of the package and part of the attraction of working with us is you get access to his world-class knowledge of how to do cyber risk management. And companies that have been with us for a while very much value that, and they continue to expand.
I mean, I think, you know, from your end, what would you say is the next sort of 6 to 12 months looking like for Acuity?
It's definitely, don't want to make any official prognostications, but definitely the future is bright here at Acuity, not only with the current pipeline and some of the exciting projects that we have coming up, but also the fact that we're going to be developing an AI native product. So we're going to have a product for every different customer segment that's important to us. We'll continue to serve our public sector and defense contractor clients. We'll have an easier to use, fast onboarding, lighter weight product for those that are currently using spreadsheets and want to move off spreadsheets and get some more sophistication in terms of their board reporting and their organization level. And then for those that are more early adopters or early middle sort of adopters, then we're going to have our Risk OS product, which takes cyber GRC to the next level. So we'll really have a more complete product portfolio, combined with some of the more secretive or sensitive projects that we have going on. And I think it will be a big success. So yeah, very much looking forward to the next 6 to 12 months.
And then a final question from me. I guess the other thing is when you look at the valuation at the moment, the company is undervalued fundamentally, just bottom line. but also the market is viewing it as it could rise to, you know, just like a 6x revenue multiple, right? Whereas actually, for all of the reasons I just described, but also this artificial intelligence product you're creating, the company could be valued in the future when this releases on artificial intelligence multiples, on sovereign AI multiples, on defense sector multiples, on public sector multiples. Mm. And those are a lot more extreme, maybe is the right word.
Yep.
And your ability to value the company much higher in the next few months, it just becomes, you know, we're in this kind of insane world almost where if you say, I'm starting up a company and I'm using AI, the checkbooks just get opened up, don't they? It just seems to be the way. But if you are a company that already has revenue, already has public sector connections, already has that sort of open line into defense and technology, when you then release this product, the second you land a first customer, analysts, and I include myself in this, can look at you and say, actually, we can value you on a different metric basis. And that maybe is where the blue sky potential comes in.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have the ability to grow rapidly, especially in this AI native world where you're charging by token usage. So we can put a margin on top of that. And when clients are getting great value from our product, they're going to be using more tokens. And really that unlocks a huge amount of potential revenue.
Exponential almost.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So David, I think for that reason, it is quite exciting.
I think quite exciting. I think would describe Acuity right now. Mm-hmm. And when this product launches, we can go from quite exciting to very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yes, David, absolutely.
Lovely to chat to you.
Really, really strong and very much motivated and moving forward. So that, yeah, it's a good time to be at Acuity.
Good time to be in, and a good time to be investing in it, though not financial advice. David, lovely to chat to you, and we will speak again soon.
Thanks, Charles.
Scott Gilbert, CEO of Corsair PLC. Welcome to Monday Upbeat Markets.
Hi, Graham. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. You're welcome. Scott, so for people that don't know who you are, tell us a bit about your background and how you became the leader of Corsair.
Well, I started my career in the oil field services back in 2008. Actually, one of my first jobs in the industry was in Angola, 2009. I spent a number of years working across Sub-Saharan Africa, worked across the Middle East. I spent my career always very close to Angola. I worked for some of the service companies you may have heard of, like Halliburton and Weatherford. In 2015, I left, full-time employment with these companies, and I went on to start a small investment vehicle. And we started to invest and build businesses across Africa and Latin America. And actually, one of the projects that we started was Apex, which is now Corsair. It was a project, a company that I started with Geraldine Giraldo, who's the co-founder of Apex and Corsair. And yeah, we started Apex with the idea of investing in the oil and gas sector in Angola. We got awarded three assets on the onshore Kwanza Basin. And as that consolidated, we reversed Apex into what is now Corsair. Exactly 2 years ago, Geraldine and I became the management of the company, and we've just been in an amazing growth trajectory since then. What we're trying to build is a Africa, Latin America focused oil and gas company with high impact exploration efforts across these two regions.
Okay. Is there anything you could, you know, as a sort of quick synopsis, of course, I know you said you want to be sort of like a high impact oil and gas specialist in Africa, but is there a quick synopsis on Corsair specifically?
Yeah, I mean, Corsair is, in essence, we're a high impact oil and gas exploration company focused on Sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America with currently assets in the onshore Kwanza Basin. So we have three main assets. Two of them are non-operated. They're operated by Angola's national oil company, they're brownfields. This is where oil sort of areas where oil was first discovered in Angola in the Kwanza Basin. And the other asset is Con 16, which is an asset that we operate. And this is where we plan to be drilling our well in the next 12 months. So in Angola, in sub-Saharan Africa, we've got exploration assets, and we are doing business development and commercial efforts to secure production assets across the Latin America region.
Yeah, so Con 16, I mean, that seems to be the focus of Corcel at the moment. Why is this such a special asset to the company?
Well, I think if we just to zoom out before going into Con 16, I mean, the first thing that I'd want to say is that we operate in the Kwanza Basin where we know there's a working petroleum system, right? So yes, it is frontier exploration in the traditional sense, but we know that there's a presence of hydrocarbons. Like I said, this is where oil was first discovered in Angola many decades ago. So then if we look at Con 16 specifically, I guess it's really the scale of the opportunity. So we've got a block that is 1,000 square kilometers. So it's quite a large area that we have, and within this block we've identified several prospects, some of which are post-salt and some of which are pre-salt prospects. And actually what's very interesting is some of these prospects are stacked, right? So we have a post-salt prospect that sits above a pre-salt prospect. And what that means is that we could potentially drill those two prospects with one well. So we've got features like this that make this block extremely exciting. Now, what makes it unique really is the economics. When you look at what you potentially may have in this block, when you combine the potential scale of the resource with the fact that it's onshore, you're potentially looking at an offshore price for an onshore cost, right? So an offshore exploration well could cost you north of $100 million. Onshore, you're looking at a fraction with that. And when you're potentially targeting resources of the similar magnitude that you are in the pre-salt offshore, then it becomes a very interesting value proposition and potential outcome if the oil is there.
Yeah. So the idea is that, you know, if you can target pre-salt and post-salt, I mean, the problem with the pre-salt plays, the pure pre-salts, is the reward is obviously massive if you find something, because the salt forms a seal and therefore the hydrocarbon field could be huge. But the risk of it is, you know, extracting it is difficult on an engineering level, because the salt creates seismic noise, right? So it's difficult to image the structures. But if you can spend the same money drilling something that's pre-salt and post-salt, two different horizons, then that pre-salt play, you're sharing the capex cost of the drill. And that's where the money savings can be, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's partly what I'm saying. But I guess what I'm also saying is that there's absolutely no doubt that we have a pre-salt prospect, right? We have a drillable prospect. So this prospect has to be drilled. It's once we drill it and we have a discovery, once we appraise it, that we'll understand its magnitude. But it's clear from the data that we have. And remember, we have data that goes back to 2010, which is what we call the legacy seismic. We've got the EFTG, which is a gradiometry survey that we carried out. And then there's 326 line kilometers of 2D seismic that we just concluded. And these pieces of data together tell us that, hey, we've got several prospects, but by the way, your primary prospect in the pre-salt, it's very attractive, it's very interesting, and needs to be drilled.
Hmm. And in terms of chance of success, and also not just chance of success, what does a good result look like to you? you go drilling, what are you hoping to find? And we won't hold you to it, but cross your fingers. I can see you smiling. Yeah.
I think you know, if we you know, I can refer you to analyst notes on you know, the potential of the main prospect that we're planning to drill. But I mean, you know, if we look at onshore Kwanza Basin post salt discoveries back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, you're looking at you know, in the lower end 10, 20, 30 million barrels of recoverable oil. Mm-hmm. And then if you start to look at the other end in terms of the pre-salt and some of the discoveries that have occurred in Angola, I mean, you're looking in the hundreds of millions of recoverable oil. So you know, we're hoping to be in the high end, and of course it's science, it's geology, it's all about you know, what we're able to find when we get down there. But you know, we're very excited from looking at the data that we have. And yeah, we're committed to drilling this well and going down there to explore and see what we can find.
Hmm. I guess the last one for me, before I hand back to Graham, the other advantage you have is that, you know, there are operators right next door. There are people who are looking at what you're doing. One of the common risks that you have with frontier exploration or any kind of major exploration at all is that, okay, you find a discovery, you've got to convince someone to develop your field, right? But I think if you find something, that would be the least of your concerns compared to other people working elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, I think I go back to you know, one of the unique aspects of Con-16. I mean, we're onshore. We're in an oil country, right? Angola is the second largest producer of oil in sub-Saharan Africa. It's a place where I think out of the all the majors, international oil companies, I mean, most of them are present in Angola with multi-billion-dollar infrastructure and investment. Mm-hmm. You've got a regulatory environment that is very, very friendly to international investment. So you've got everything in Angola to be able to develop something big that may be discovered in the Kwanza Basin. So I think obviously a big discovery comes with its challenges, but I guess we're not concerned about. As I say, it's a good challenge to have when we have a discovery. So yeah, like you say, all the international oil companies are there. It's a very sophisticated environment from an oil and gas perspective. And so, you know, you've got refinery about 100 kilometers away from where we're going to be drilling. I think getting to a place where we have a discovery and we're going to develop this, it's going to be a very exciting time for Corcel.
Mm-hmm.
So, Scott, Corcel owns about 75% of Con-16, correct?
Corcel has a net interest in Con-16 of 71.5%. It has a controlling working interest through Apex of 85%. So yeah, round about those numbers.
Okay, all right. And once you've done the farm outs, presuming that's what you're going through, you're doing the processing of the seismic. But once you hopefully you're going to get some farm out partners, what do you hope to end up having in an ideal world after you've done the farming out?
It's very hard to put a number on what we may be left with in terms of interest in the block once a farm out process is completed, because it's going to depend on many things. It's going to depend on whether we get a farm out process for one well, a farm out transaction that pays for one well, whether it pays for two wells. It's going to be down to, you know, to the partner that comes in, and there's a series of terms and conditions and aspects of the farm and transaction that will determine how much we stay with. But of course, I mean, our intention is to keep as much as we can of the block and get the best terms we can for our shareholders.
Okay. Now, see, from our experience with Afentra, they're partners with the the Sonigul project, sorry, is they have partners like M&P, Chevron, Eni. These are sort of, I'm not asking you to be specific, but are they is that the sort of caliber that could be farming into Con 16? Or are they smaller companies that no one's heard
of? I can't really give specifics at this time, but what I can tell you is that we've had a significant amount of I would say unsolicited interest in farming into Con 16, and that's come from a range of companies. Mid-cap companies, be it private, public. We've had interest from financial investors. So I think the Kwanzaa Basin has become extremely interesting. Of course, we were the first company, one of the first international companies, at least London listed, to acquire acreage in the Kwanzaa Basin. I mean, we were awarded our assets 2021-2022. Back then there was very little interest in the Kwanzaa Basin, and now we're seeing more and more interest coming our way or coming to the basin in general. I think our block is of particular interest because of all the things that I described earlier. So we've had a lot of interest. And ultimately, it's not whether it's a large company or an IOC or a mid-cap. It's about the right company and the right fit for what we're trying to do and what's gonna generate the best value to our shareholders, but also give us the best chance of succeeding in terms of our discovery. And then later, we talked about a development program. So it's about combining the right partner for the entire journey of the Con 16 project.
Okay. You've been operating in Angola for quite a long time, more than most people. How do you see the safety, the security of tenure? How do you see that in Angola for now and the foreseeable future?
I'm confident in the jurisdiction that we are operating in. I think Angola is a place that has attracted a lot of interest, like I mentioned a little while ago. But I go back to what I say very often. Angola has one of the most established oil and gas industries in Africa. Again, many of the world's largest and most sophisticated oil and gas energy companies have operated or are operating in Angola, and we continue to see significant investment from these countries. So from a regulatory and operating perspective, the government has made a considerable amount of efforts to attract investment and to support development of the sector. The continued presence of majors in Angola, it's testament to that. So I'm not concerned about contractual safety, contractual security, and tenure in Angola. In fact, it's one of the things that I'm most, I would say, relaxed about.
Okay, you're hoping to drill, assuming you get successful partners. You're hoping to drill when, if the seismic all comes in correctly.
Yeah, so we're in the process of processing the seismic data from the 2D seismic campaign we just concluded. That's still got maybe a month or so to go. We're gonna have results from that. That data is gonna be interpreted. In parallel, we're working on our well design. We are shopping for rigs. We are working on our field development plan, which of course comes on the back of our discovery. So there's several parallels happening at the same time, and all of these need to be in place before we spud the well, before we start drilling. So we anticipate to be drilling within the next 12 months. We're making all the efforts that we can to get there. It's the farming process, it's the field development plan, it's the well engineering, it's the procurement, obviously making sure that we do this safely and with no incidents, no accidents. So there's a lot of planning that's going into making this happen successfully.
Wonderful. Yeah, I think it's just one of those stories where get the farm in, get Madrill in, get the result that you're looking for, and then patience will be rewarded. I think that kind of sums it up quite nicely. Yeah, Scott, it's been lovely to chat to you, and thank you very much for jumping on. We know that you've been very busy recently, and we hope to speak to you again in the near future.
Thank you, Charles. I appreciate you having me on.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, so that was those two interviews out of the way. Hopefully they all do rather well. But what's happening in the markets? Any comments from anybody?
Well, I put my neck on the line over the weekend there in the Sunday roast by saying these are my 10 baggers. So we'll see how those react. We've seen a reaction in extract resources this morning. Up a small amount. I think it's up 5 to 10%. But I just think they've got great potential. Same with Energy Pathways. Same with quite a few of them. Aterian. What else did we say? Active Energy. I believe that this is all about revenue. These companies are going to be producing revenue, and when you produce cash flow, free cash flow, you have two choices. You can either distribute it back to the shareholders, or you can basically reinvest in yourself and grow even bigger. So I think there's big potential in all of those. But from the news this morning, I'd like to point out the Coiled Therapeutics news. They have appointed a doctor who is supposedly very renowned in this particular area, and is basically saying that this company has a great chance of achieving what many haven't, which is to help shrink and get rid of these cancers or these cancer tumors. So, again, I'm rubbish at pronouncing, as you all know. Appointment of Professor Ozgur Sahin as chief, as scientific advisor. His comment was very good. AO252 represents one of the most exciting opportunities I've seen in precision oncology, and the recent clinical data are highly encouraging. I look forward to working with Sridhar and the Core Therapeutics team to help realize the full potential of this program for patients with significant unmet needs.
Okay, very good. All right, anything catching your eye, Charles?
I think it's there's always things catching my eye. I mean, what I'd like to mention is Buccaneer Energy, because we kind of like these turnaround plays. And a note came out from SP Angel reiterating a buy recommendation and a target price of 0.05p. So you're looking at a 300-350% potential upside. I mean, that basically aligns with what I was saying a month or two ago. And I just think, a lot of the stuff that we cover is quite high risk and quite binary, particularly in oil and gas. But in this one, it's just a case of uprating production. So the risk profile is much lower. And ultimately, if you're generating revenue, then the market has to re-rate, simple as that. So that's one I'm quite enjoying looking at. In terms of what's going on kind of more broadly, we're watching all these pre-IPOs, RTOs, IPOs hit the market. Many of them are trying to come to the market at the same time. And obviously, the wider market is kind of all over the place. You've got gold kind of racing up and down. You've got the Strait of Hormuz and what's going on with Iran. No one's quite sure whether a peace deal is going to come or whether it's going to stay closed for longer. You're having notes coming out of Russia and Ukraine. Actually, it sounds like they're closer to a peace deal than they might have been in the past. And at the same time, you've got the SpaceX, the Anthropic, and the OpenAI IPOs. all of which are going to command a massive amount of capital. And it's quite hard to know whether the party keeps on going or whether it cools off a bit. And I'm not talking sort of like a big crash just yet, but it all just feel a little bit frothy. Now, if you've got loads and loads of companies trying to get into the market in the height of the froth, ideally it stays really red hot, the market, for the next few months until some holidays kick off. And then everyone gets away really happily. But if not, it'll be interesting to see how they progress. But ultimately, a lot of the stuff coming to the market is really, really interesting and has really strong potential. Many of them are private companies that have been hanging around for a while and just didn't think the right time to list had come. And now they've all decided that June/July 2026 is the way to be. So we shall see.
Yeah, very good. I see that Jensen Huang has said that the AI pullback is a buying opportunity. And then
shock horror, he would say that.
Yeah. True. And then who was the other one? Tuchman, or Tuchman, I don't know how you pronounce his last name. Einstein of Wall Street was commentating, I think, on Thursday at this market. This is before the 1,000-point drop on the NASDAQ. It's way too overheated. Needs to come down. And now, you know, you've had that drop. Maybe there's a bit. Do you think there's more to follow through on the NASDAQ on the downside, or do you think that was the job was done on Friday?
I think the Trump administration and the tech sector in general, they don't want anything massive to happen until these IPOs are launched, because there's too much skin in the game. But you know, the problem is you've got so many macro events that are outside of any one party's hands. You've got obviously Russia, Ukraine. You've got China looking at Taiwan. You've got the Strait of Hormuz and the inflation happening there. There's so much geopolitical risk in the market. And yet the problem is, because there's geopolitical risk, you kind of have to invest your money because inflation is going up, so you don't really have a choice. So it pushes the markets higher. I do think, you know, it is overheated. And obviously the dot-com analogy is pretty useful because you can be right and you can still lose money initially, you know? And you don't even need to look at dot-com and the crash there. If you look at like the Facebook IPO, what later became Meta Platforms, really overheated. And then the first 100 days, it dropped 70%, right? Now, we can't guarantee or say that that's going to happen with SpaceX or with Anthropic or with OpenAI. But it's possible to say that artificial intelligence will change the world like the internet did, but that you can invest all of your money into companies that are going to do incredibly well over the next couple of decades. But you might be buying at the peak and waiting a decade for the market to catch back up.
Okay. Yeah, that's...
The question is that if you've got a $1.77 trillion valuation and you're only raising 5%, $85 million, and most of the institutions have said, get lost, it's too expensive. So in other words, it's now gone to retail and retail's piling in. The scenario is that the other 95%, though they are locked in, most of them are locked in for a few months. If you've literally 100 times your money, maybe 10 times your money, 50 times your money, which is possible in all of those cases for people who've invested significant in SpaceX, you're going to take some off the table.
Yeah.
Even Google, I think, have invested in SpaceX, no?
The irony is Google has an equity position in SpaceX. And so when they give SpaceX a revenue contract, as in they say, you know, we're going to buy revenue from you, then their equity position rises by a multiple of the revenue contract that they've given SpaceX. So it's all a big fugazi, really. But ultimately, if you look at the employee situation, like, for example, you know, I have shares in a couple of FTSE 100 blue chip companies that I freelanced at, right, over the past few years. And most of them are vested, right, or locked up. But if, for example, I had shares in, let's say, Rolls-Royce, and I was given them when I invested, right at the very bottom of the pandemic bottom, and now they've, you know, 15 or 20x'd. Imagine it was a private company. And then it IPO'd tomorrow. The second I got an unlock, you know, you got to bear in mind a lot of these people didn't earn very much money at SpaceX, and they were just generic employees who happened to get shares on top of their, you know, standard salary. And so, you know, you can have people earning sort of $60,000-$70,000 a year sitting on a paper fortune of a couple of million dollars. You know, and at some point relatively soon, they're going to be able to unlock that paper fortune. And you're going to have a wall of sellers, because the other thing is, it's to a lot of them, it's a lot of them, it's their life, but to many of them, it's just an employer that they had at one point. You know, in exactly the same way as, you know, when a company are RTOs, and then you might have shares in the shell that you'd written off forever, and one day you wake up and, like, for whatever reason, that share price has rocketed back up. You don't look to check why, you just sell, because you have no interest in the new company, you just want your money back. And yeah, and that's what a lot of SpaceX IPOs will be like. But on the flip side, obviously, if you actually, so the valuation is bonkers, but then the valuation of Tesla is insane as well, right? And it's been fine for years. And you're, I mean, for me anyway, your problem is, in terms of, like, it's very hard to short this. It's very hard to go long on it because the fundamentals don't match. But the other reality is that it occupies, you know, we talk trailblazer valuations here. It occupies the space that nobody else can possibly, it has a moat that no one can replace. If he does get to Mars or starts mining the moon or whatever, the profit potential is just crazy. But right now,
yeah, but ultimately, that's, I think, decades away. No, you know, it's the type of profit he's talking about is not coming for many years. I don't care what anybody says. The reality is that I think the institutions thought it was worth potentially what, 600 to 800 million. Billion. And yeah, even that is a huge amount of money, obviously. But you're not just looking at that. You're looking at Anthropic looking for a similar amount of money, I think. You're looking at Google saying a similar amount of money. So how much of Friday's was, I've got to pay for these IPOs and I need to sell down some of my other stocks to suddenly fund, you know, $250 billion in three IPOs.
It's ironic, isn't it? Because we're having almost exactly the same thing happening in small caps. You know, why you've got when you've got sort of 15-20 companies trying to come to market in the next couple of months, what kind of pressure is that going to put on companies that are currently listed? Anything that's liquid, you know, I don't care what anybody says. You know, if the problem is if you've signed a placing letter or you've made a verbal commitment over the past 6 months, often you're expecting the IPOs or the demands for capital to be staggered over a few weeks, a few months, and it's just not happened. So if you're like me and you're worried about a market crash and you're sitting on a bit of cash, then you're fine. But if you're not, to fund those placing commitments, you're going to have to sell something. And that's why the current market's good. Now, the flip side of that, obviously, is that if the IPOs get away and they all rise because we're in a rising boat market, suddenly you're going to have a load of companies and a load of people sitting on tons of paper profit. And then that's going to push on the bull market in small caps after the summer. And exactly the same way with SpaceX and Anthropic and OpenAI. Yes, at the moment, you know, in the US, you've got large investors, institutional investors selling to fund those IPOs. So the IPOs get away and they take off and the party continues. Suddenly you've got tons more cash rolling around the market. So it'll be interesting to see. But I'm fascinated that we have this dichotomy where it's happening in small caps at the same time as for large caps. And I'm not entirely sure why, but it is definitely the case.
Yeah, indeed. I think the difference between the small cap and what we're talking about in the tech giants is, you know, they're just mental valuations. I mean, we're talking about trillions of dollars, not billions of dollars. And, you know, we're talking about little old Forgent who signed a contract or another option for a deal with a jork, and the company's worth about £3 or 4 million, you know, and it's like, it's mind-blowing, the differential, you know. And the reality is that those big tech companies, they don't depend on the small miners. But if we don't get the metal out of the ground, they're not going to have businesses to worry about in the big tech situation. So it's like chicken and egg, which comes first?
Well,
is it the metal that's required to produce the infrastructure for the tech, or is it the tech? Which comes first?
Well, it's both. I mean, the interesting thing is it's top and bottom, right? Because the vast majority of the market attention is focused on the center, which is the large language models, the Claudes for Geminis, the ChatGPTs. But ultimately, those are just commodities because, you know, in 2022, when OpenAI, when ChatGPT launched, it was the trailblazing leader, right? And then Gemini overtook it fairly quickly. And now pretty much everyone I know in the corporate space is using Claude for their AI needs. The second a better model drops from another company, whether that's a startup or whether Google improves Gemini or whether OpenAI comes back, then people will just migrate. So there's no economic moat around it. So the metal, everyone needs the metal, and obviously everyone needs the fabs to build the semiconductors, and that's what you have at the very bottom of the chain. But actually where the real money is going to get made over the next few years is going to be the top of the chain, so the stuff that's built on top of the language models. And that's where there's going to be differentiation. And interestingly, it seems that no one's quite picked up on that yet. But it'll be interesting to see if anybody does, because that's where the money will be made, at the very top, above the language models, and at the very bottom, at the metal, because that's where the two bottlenecks are. But yeah, we'll see who wins first.
I do wonder about that. You know, we were talking about SpaceX and the fact that, you know, Musk has been talking about sourcing energy from space.
Mm.
Imagine like harnessing energy from the sun, but you only have to use a 1/100th of what you would use on Earth, and then putting that energy back into Earth. Would that then potentially make what's happening on Earth redundant?
I mean, possibly. I mean, that's the big thing, isn't it? I mean, the other thing is, you know, Musk wants to go establish a million person colony on Mars, and there's a load of obviously technical challenges for people living on Mars permanently. But the two big ones are, you know, lack of atmosphere and, you know, lack of running water. Now, if you solve AGI as an artificial, general intelligence for AI, and then you solve quantum computing and apply that to quantum computing, and you solve nuclear fusion, all of which are making big strides ahead, then you have unlimited compute with unlimited energy, and those problems can be solved. And then the only thing that you need is the head start, so you need to be the company with the rockets, with the satellites. And I think the thing is, it's a huge, huge gamble. But imagine you have the ability to to mine Mars, to set up another colony, another GDP, another global GDP on another planet. It makes everything else that every other company do look ridiculously tiny. And yet, obviously, it's kind of like, you know, we've all done those interviews, or like someone sends over a pitch deck, right? And you know, the market, they're like, we want to raise 500 grand and our total addressable market is like $400 trillion, and you just look at it and you go, it's ridiculous. But then Elon Musk, I mean, I remember he had like a bonus scheme if Tesla shares got to a specific point, or, you know, and they got to certain corporate milestones, and everyone says, it's ridiculous, it'll never happen. And then he hit those milestones, and then suddenly, like, the legal system and like shareholders tried to block him getting his money and his shares, but he'd done the impossible. And I'd say, while I think on a fundamental level, SpaceX is hugely overvalued, and, you know, in any real world, after the IPO hype, it should drop substantially. Betting against Musk has historically not been a good idea. So,
wait for Musk to settle and then
see.
Well, in percentage terms, are you going to make a lot of money on SpaceX? I mean, I can't see it doing 100%. You know, anytime soon, but you never know, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, like, for the private investor, is it one for the private investor, is it one for the institutions that can lock things up?
You know, like, on AIM, you know, I was saying, I wrote an article about it over the weekend. I was like, would it, if this was like an AIM IPO, would the Nomad be happy for, you know, 30% of the shares being going to retail through the wrap system? Which is effectively what SpaceX, literally exactly what SpaceX is doing. No, you know, and Nomads will have a lot of things, being realistic. Now, the problem is that if you just let all retail investors take, you know, buy into this stock, the risk parameters around it is they're just, the retail just aren't informed. This is a reality around it. You know, the average retail investor, not the small cap investor, the people listening to this podcast generally are, you know, have a bit of money and know what they're doing, because you just kind of have to be like working in this space. But the average person who just buys index funds and gets offered the SpaceX IPO, and it's the first IPO they've ever been offered, and it looks really cool when Elon Musk is involved, puts money in, and it quite easily becomes, you know, the exit liquidity for a Silicon Valley hedge fund. And yeah. But we shall see. I mean, Kevin says, you know, will you actually make money on the SpaceX IPO? You know, Donald Trump, let's say he posts on Truth Social 5 minutes after it launches, SpaceX looks amazing, we're going to fund it with US government money, loads more than we have done in the past. And you know, that I think is a very real possibility, because, you know, he's done it before, why would he not? And then if he does that, oh, we're up 30% in the first 10 minutes of trading. So impossible to know, but we shall see.
Same for you, Charles.
Yeah, good. I think we're good to go.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening in. Don't forget, if you like what you see, please like and subscribe. And remember, mum's the word.
This podcast was brought to you by Monday Upbeat Markets. If you would like to appear on a future episode of the Mums Podcast, please email mondayupbeatmarkets@gmail.com.